Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll get to part one, a conversation about the comic opera La Serva Padrona by Pergolesi in just a moment. We want to remind you one more time about the Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Drive. You can make your donation to Wisconsin Public Radio at www.wpr.org or by calling them toll-free at 888-202-2552. And when you do, please mention that you are a listener to WGTD and to The Morning Show. And we thank you for your support. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am always happy when I get to talk about opera on the morning show, and especially when I can do so with two friends, Nick Berudian, who is the general director of the Bell Ensemble. And I'm sure you have heard a lot about the Bell Ensemble if you follow classical music here in southeastern Wisconsin at all. And certainly on the morning show, we've talked on several occasions about some of the wonderful things that the Bell Ensemble has done. And it's currently in its third season.
That's right.
Yeah. And a lot of wonderful music making has already taken place. And many of the performances have involved tenor Edson Melendez, who is joining us as well on today's morning show. They are both here to talk about two performances occurring this weekend of one of the great comic masterpieces in operatic history, La Serva Padrona by Giovanni Pergolesi. And this is one of those pieces that is really important in history and a really delightful bit of entertainment. And yet the kind of opera that something like the Lyric Opera of Chicago or the Milwaukee Florentine is most unlikely to ever present. And so it's actually not all that commonly done. And so this is actually a rare treat to encounter this really important piece, one of the first really significant and influential comic operas. So Nick Berudian, Edson Melendez, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks, morning. Greg.
Good to have you here. Nick, just sketch for us what has unfolded thus far in terms of this third season of the Bell Ensemble.
This third season represents a real growth for us. We put on two big programs in the fall, one called A Cappella from Palestrina to Pentatonix. And so that involved not only 12 singers with the Bell Ensemble, but it was done in collaboration with Parkside Range, the collegiate a cappella group directed by Bell Ensemble member and Parkside faculty, Amy Boudersee. And that was a wonderful collaboration and a really good way to kick off our season. Later in the fall, we performed a program we entitled Musical Mystics. It was all music of Samuel Barber and Benjamin Britten, and of a more spiritual or religiously motivated variety. And so we got to perform a couple of larger works by those composers, St. Cecilia, the hymn to St. Cecilia by Britten, and his canticle number 2, Abraham and Isaac, and then the entire Hermit Songs of Samuel Barber, as well as some other things. So it was a kind of a heavy fall, and now that we're in the middle of winter and looking towards spring, some lighter material is what we're doing. But can I tell you about Under the Tuscan Moon?
Absolutely, yes. That's the thing you just did, right?
Right. This is the most consistent part of our programming, actually, over the course of the last 3 years.
All the drinking.
Wine and song pairings. You've heard of wine and cheese pairings or wine and meat pairings. Well, none of that for us. That's okay, but we prefer to pair our wine with songs. And so one of the most successful events we've had is this Under the Tuscan Moon. We've put on these wine and song pairings in collaboration with Uncorked Downtown Racine Wine Shop, and Tony Begonia there has been a great friend and partner to the Bell Ensemble. And so we provide he provides the samples of fine Italian wines, and we sing fine Italian music. And Edson could tell you more about that program. Edson Melendez, who's here with me, is the board member for he's our artistic advisor on the board, and has done quite a bit of behind the scenes work in terms of programming too. He designed the program for Under the Tuscan Moon.
Oh, what did you think about in putting that together?
Well, it's a really fun evening. I have a huge passion, as you know, for Italian music, and not only the great operatic works, but also a lot of the lesser known Neapolitan songs and things of that nature. One thing that we tried to focus on as we built that program was the influence of Italian music on American music. So it was actually a really balanced program where you heard some old Italian classics, some very fun and very interesting things that you've heard a billion times if you've ever spent any time in any Italian restaurant or an Italian Nona's kitchen or something like that. Mm. But then we built it into some of the more pop stylings that Italian Americans contributed to, songs by people like Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Connie Francis, and things of that nature. And then, as Nick was saying, this is a wine and music pairing. So what we do is we try to pick pieces that somehow exemplify characteristics of the wine. So the wine and the music come together, and you know, as you hear these pieces, you can sip on the wine and hopefully get some different notes of the different various wines and some different notes musically as well.
Mm. Oh, fun. And after what we're talking about today, something sort of similar is next for Bell Ensemble, right?
Indeed. We have our first ever French wine and song pairing. April in Paris takes place also at Uncorked. And that's April 21st. As long as I'm telling you about it, tickets are $25 a person for five generous samplings of wine and all of the entertainment and light refreshments. And 7 o'clock, April 21st, those tickets will be available soon on the Bell Ensemble website.
I love the titles you come up with, to say nothing of the ideas of all these various programs that you've put together. You have a real knack for this, and I know a lot of people really appreciate what the Bell Ensemble has brought to southeastern Wisconsin. So whose idea was it to do this comic opera this coming weekend as part of the Bell Ensemble season? And I mean, where did that idea come from?
Edson may actually remember better than I do. We talked at length about the possibility of a staged work of some sort before even committing to that, because it is such a larger endeavor than any of our previous projects. The whole process of finding a venue that can accommodate that and building or obtaining a set and a stage and props and everything, not to mention the accompaniment and orchestra. And this came up as a possibility that was both manageable for us and fit kind of into the niche that we want to fill, which, as you were describing it before, we want to bring performances to the area that are not already being brought and that are going to be a really a unique experience and enjoyable for people.
That's definitely how it came about. The genesis of this was a matter of practicality. We couldn't really put together a work with 40, 50 singers and a huge set and a full orchestra. So we thought about some chamber options, and we discussed several different things. And this seemed to fit. You know, there are two singing characters and one silent character who is a local actor. And we thought, well, you know, we've done some heavy stuff in the fall. Let's do something light and comic in the spring and or late winter. And the other thing that really kind of resonated with us is a little bit of, you know, thematic material with the current climate that we have and several different movements that are empowering women, we decided to choose a show that really puts a woman in the driver's seat. And there is no show without Serpina. She is driving everybody all over this stage, and she does it with wit and charm and intelligence, rather than just pure, you know, sexuality or something like that. She does it really with her brain and her ability to read people. So we thought that was a good message for the times that we live in as well.
That's well put, and I agree. So maybe this is as good a time as any to kind of talk about the essential plot of La Serva Padrona. What is this relatively simple story about?
Well, basically, there's a young servant lady in our production. She's really more of a secretary than a servant in a home. Mm. We're kind of changing the location to more of an office than an actual home. She is employed by Uberto. Her name is Serpina. She's employed by Uberto. And she's decided that she no longer wants to be in this subservient position, that she would like to be running the show. So she's got to trick Uberto or convince Uberto that to marry her so that she can run the show. And it's actually quite easily done. It begins with her being just a very obstinate employee and not wanting to do what she has been asked to do. For instance, at the top of the show, he has been waiting now 3 hours for a cup of chocolate. And she just doesn't want to do it, so she doesn't do it. And that, you know, that kind of promotes an argument that takes up most of the show until she says, he says that the way to fix her attitude is by going out and getting married and having a woman in the house or office. And she says, well, if you're going to marry somebody, you might as well marry me. And then she's got to convince him of that. And so it's very charming and it's very comical. And these characters, you know, based off of old Commedia dell'arte characters, have their little ways that they react that makes the situation very, very funny. Mm.
Mm. My recollection is that this is not a particularly long work. How long is it start to finish?
That's an interesting part of the history of this work. It was written as intermezzo for a much longer opera seria that Pergolesi had written, Il Prigionier Superbo, the Proud Prisoner, which nobody has heard of. I mean, that was not a significant moment in his output. But this intermezzo was written as sort of like intermission entertainment, you know, like between the three long acts of this serious opera were these two segments of a shorter, much lighter comic story. And of course, this is the one that is known now because of its effect on helping other composers take off with comic opera. So the complete length of the opera is about 45 minutes, probably a little under 45 minutes.
So for somebody who's not fully convinced of that they want to see a full opera, this is actually a wonderful way to start. I mean, you're not sitting through something long, and plus it's lighthearted, plus it's tuneful. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which this is a great opera for even not particularly enthusiastic opera fan to see.
No, absolutely. And, you know, for those worried about the language issues, we do have super titles. They're kind of side titles. I don't know. We wouldn't call them subtitles or super titles. I don't know what we call them when they're on the side. But, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, the whole length of the program will be about an hour. There is a small string quartet that's going to open by Nardini, a contemporary of Pergolesi's. And part of what we did, since Pergolesi was so, or this work is so instrumental in setting up the work of Mozart and Haydn and Salieri, in the, you know, predates them by about 50 years, really their comic works by about 50 years, we chose a string quartet by Nardini, who also predates Haydn by a few years, and set up the work for Haydn. Previous to Haydn, nobody was really writing string quartets the way that Haydn did. except for Nardini. Nardini was kind of the genesis of that. So these are both really important works in the development of musical history, operatic history, and string repertoire. So we decided to include a little example of that as well at the top of our show. So the whole thing is an hour. It's all lighthearted, tuneful music, like you say. Very beautiful music that is still at a very high level.
Right. And really funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a funny show, and some of the music is funny. And, I mean, the music very much underlines the comedy. So,
and this silent character, Vespone, he's silent. He doesn't have any lines that are in the score at all. And just occasionally there's a note that, you know, Serpina at this point hits Vespone or something. I mean, that's what we know about him. But Edson's done some really exciting things with making that character more of a presence on the stage.
Mm.
And Mike Kishline, who has done a lot with Racine Theatre Guild, and he's our Vespone, and he's just hilarious without ever saying a word.
Mm.
He's an incredible physical actor, and actually Mike and I go back to high school, and yeah, the things that he's able to do with his face and with his physicality really bring a whole another element of comedy that's beyond the music.
Fantastic. And that's, of course, another reason why this work is so approachable is the small cast. That, I mean, sometimes when you see something like Don Carlo or whatever, it's like, oh, so who is that again? And why are these people, why do they hate each other and so on? I mean, there is a simplicity and focus about what happens in terms of number of characters and what's going on.
One scene.
Right.
It doesn't change location.
Yeah, it's very good. So this is being done at DeCoven Center in the Assembly Hall. Explain why that space was chosen, why it works well for this.
It was free. A number of reasons. It's a beautiful space to sing in, first of all. You know, it's wood floors, wood ceilings, so the sound in there is great. The singers sound marvelous in there. The instruments sound marvelous in there. We've erected a small playing area. It's really only about 16 by 16. And some of the natural architecture of the building just lent itself to what we were going to be doing. So there was that. Also, having this be a piece from the 1700s that we're trying to update, sometimes that can seem a little bit forced. And we didn't want to. And I think the natural architectural elements of the building also lend itself to kind of a nondescript time. We'll be in an office. They'll be in more modern costuming. But the location kind of goes, well, we're not way back in the day, but we're not way present in the future either. So it gave us some flexibility there that was really kind. And then I'll let Nick talk about how the DeCoven Center has been just really helpful to us.
The DeCoven Center has been a fantastic partner for the Bell Ensemble. We held a big fundraiser on their grounds last summer, a garden gala, and this is La Serva Padrona is the second time that they've really generously provided space that we can perform in. Max Dersham, director of the DeCoven Center, and I began talking a little over a year ago, and the DeCoven Center actually serves now as a fiscal receiver for the Bell Ensemble.
Oh.
So that people can make a donation to the Bell Ensemble. They can make a donation and write the check out to the DeCoven Center with an earmark for the Bell Ensemble. And then through the tax-exempt status of the DeCoven Center, that gift to the Bell Ensemble is tax-exempt.
Oh.
So that's been really great for us as we've developed because, you know, you don't just start an organization and apply for 501c3 status, which would otherwise provide that kind of tax-exempt ability for gifts. We're still in the process of that right now. In fact, at this moment, our application for non-stock corporation status in the state of Wisconsin is being processed. And after that, that allows us then to apply for 501c3 status.
Okay. So in the meantime,
the DeKoven Center has been a great friend.
Very good. And I can well imagine this space working wonderfully for this. Talk about your singers.
Yeah, we have two fabulous acting singers, Shelly Melendez and Justino Carano. Shelly Melendez, soprano, from the area. She's from Racine, originally graduated from Horlick High School back in, I won't say that because she won't let me back in the house. And Justino Carano, who performs with Florentine Opera, I think has done some work with some other groups in the Chicago area. And is currently residing in Michigan, but came back to be part of this production. And they're both wonderful, young, up-and-coming singers, really making a splash all around the area. And we were lucky enough to engage them both for this production. And then, of course, our non-singing character, which we spoke of already, Mike Kishline, who is a Kenosha native, like myself. And, yeah, he's absolutely fabulous. And he's done tons of work with Racine Theater Guild, Sixth Street Theater, I think Lakeside Players, most of the area theater companies.
Right, know him well, and I've spoken to Mike a couple of times. He's absolutely thrilled to be part of this and having a ball. So yeah. I can well imagine what he adds to it. Nick, say a quick word about the accompaniment, the so-called orchestra that you'll be conducting. That I, from the sounds of it, will actually work really, really well for this.
It will. We're using a somewhat reduced orchestra, a string quartet, and a harpsichord. It's the full score would call for a couple of cornets as well, but that's the only thing we're really doing without. And in this space, I think our quartet will work really well. Fumi Nakayama is standing at the harpsichord for us, and she's just a marvel to hear and to watch there. And then the members of our quartet are all area local string players, I think all of whom play with either the Kenosha or the Racine Symphony Orchestras. Jessica DeBoer is our violist, Darlene Revest and Anne Lamar Heidi are violins, and Michelle Venturella on cello.
That is a great quartet, so, and Fumi is great. So sounds like everything is in place for this to be a first-rate performance. So we're actually recording this Tuesday morning, and I suppose you're in that frantic last push to get this all polished up and ready to go.
Yes, this afternoon we have a Zitzprobe, and this evening a couple of dry full runs, and then it just gets deeper.
off to the races after that.
Yeah.
Ready for an audience then to come. So remind our listeners about exactly when and where these performances take place this weekend.
Both performances take place at the DeKoven Center in their beautiful assembly hall on the lake side of the campus. Friday night, 7:30, February 23rd, and Sunday, February 25th at 3 p.m. Tickets are available through the Bell Ensemble website, or it's likely there will be tickets available at the door. So don't be afraid just to show up.
And when you come to DeKoven, then you should park towards Lake Michigan in that parking lot, front parking lot?
Yeah, you'll wanna enter from Wisconsin Avenue, from Lake Michigan side, and then park it wherever it is closest and convenient. That's where the main entry to the assembly hall will be.
Very good. We should mention, I don't think we've said it yet, that Giovanni Pergolesi died at the tender age of 26 and really did not live to create very much. But what he created was very, very special, and nothing more special than this comic gem, La Serva Padrona, so performed this weekend, Friday night and Sunday afternoon by the Bell Ensemble. Nick Berudian, Edson Melendez, great to have both of you here on the morning show. Best wishes to you and everybody involved with La Serva Padrona.
Thanks
so
Greg.
Much.
Great to be with you. Sposetta, sposetta.
Pergolesi's La Serva Padrona. The time is 8:35. Time for part two of today's morning show from the Morning Show Archives here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Well, we're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking, I'm afraid, with a New England's Patriots fan. But I think even those of you that are Packers fans or Chicago Bears fans won't mind a bit, because we're talking about a really interesting book and an interesting story. The book is called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback. And the author of the book is Richard J. King, who teaches literature at Williams College in New England, and also the author of The Devil's Cormorant and Lobster. And he is responsible for this book, which is very much the story of his own ardent and very sincere desire to meet and interview and, yes, perhaps even play a game of catch with the NFL football superstar Tom Brady, of course, one of the finest quarterbacks ever to play the game. And beyond just a great quarterback, also an extraordinarily larger-than-life figure, a true celebrity in the world of professional sports, and also, of course, someone who's been in the news as of late for some rather unfortunate reasons, shall we say. It's a great story, and I'm excited to talk with the author Richard J. King about his book, published by 4Edge. Richard J. King, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
One thing that leapt out at me as I read your book is the fact that after you've described your devotion to the New England's Patriots, and particularly your fascination with their quarterback, Tom Brady, at some point you tell us that, in fact, you're not a lifelong Patriots fan at all, and have actually been enamored with other teams, including once upon a time one of my favorite teams, the Pittsburgh Steelers, back in their glory days. You say, I've always been a fair weather fan. Tell us more about that aspect of your interest in football, your fair weather fandom, so to speak.
Yeah. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. I was an Eagles fan and a Steelers fan. I grew up, in the 70s and early 80s when, the Steel Curtain and Mean Joe Green was my guy at the time. And I had, I still have my, Mean Joe Green cards. A lot of the book is, and I think it's really for any football fans at all, and particularly for middle-aged guys, as we're sort of coming to grips with who we are and our levels of success. And I think a lot of us go to a game or to watch football to kind of feel good about the day and to sort of channel a little bit of our energies elsewhere. And so it has been hard for me to come to grips with the fact that, gosh, I've been in New England now almost 20 years. Would I be still a really devoted fan if the Patriots hadn't been so successful? And so I certainly can't claim to going back to the days when they were the Boston Patriots and they were really a doormat for the league. I'm hoping that, I can maintain and be a solid fan for the rest of for the rest of the Patriots' life.
In other words, if we could somehow turn back the clock and we were talking about the New England Patriots back in the Jim Plunkett era, back when he was their quarterback, he was talented, but the team really struggled, sometimes pathetically so. Chances are you would have had no affection whatsoever for the Patriots because they weren't winners.
Gosh, I hope not. I hope I would have been. I hope I would have been a bit more faithful. A lot of the book is really kind of thinking about what it means to be a fan and thinking about the contradictions we have all the time. And particularly now in the free agency era when, players come and go so quickly and you're really, as a lot of sports radio folks say, you're rooting for laundry, that you're just sort of rooting for the uniform. And that one of the things that's so compelling about Brady and, maybe same thing with Aaron Rodgers and other players that have been with the team for a long time, that there are really only two or three figures that really stay with the team for a long time in any given franchise.
I thought it was interesting when you said that for as devoted as you are now to the New England Patriots and to Tom Brady in particular, you are not someone who would ever wear a Tom Brady jersey, you know, that one might buy in an apparel shop. You write at one point, I wore my Pat Patriot hat proudly, but I'm not at the jersey stage yet. I'd be too embarrassed walking around wearing a football jersey with a player's name on it, even at the game itself. This is partly because I would feel like too much of a spectator, which has a listless, passive, almost defeatist connotation for me. And then you go on to say, I know I'm well aware of the irony of this belief. I'm aware that within my mission to meet Tom Brady, I'm a hairball of hypocrisy. But wearing a jersey, if you're a guy, it practically says, I wish I were this man. I find that really, really interesting because you're probably not alone in that, but I'm impressed that you're as open as you are about those particular feelings.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is this sort of adventure, the whole starting in the spring of 2013, this sort of adventure and journey into what it means to be a football fan and a sports fan. And so a lot of that is talking to people and saying, you know, particularly men, you know, in their 30s and 40s saying, would I switch lives with Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers or any, you know, Jay Cutler in it if I could, you know, for a week or, you know, completely, as you're trying to sort of evaluate yourself and what you think is important. And there is something to, you know, and I don't want to insult any listeners of, you know, grown men walking around, you know, in football jerseys like we did when we were kids. But then at the same time, here I am spending a whole year and a half of my life, you know, trying to just have a catch with this one guy. So, there's a lot of sort of working through some things, and hopefully in a funny comic way. I'm a cartoonist, and so part of the adventure was just drawing and sketching and meeting a whole bunch of people involved with being football fans.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Richard J. King, and his book is called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots quarterback. And, of course, we're talking about one of the most famous quarterbacks, indeed one of the most famous players in the NFL, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. One thing we should clarify is that as you got this idea that it would be so cool to talk with Tom Brady, that you yourself at the time were a writer, but you weren't a sports writer. So in a sense, from a professional point of view, you really had no business entertaining this notion as seriously as we might assume. Because, I mean, really, it's sports writers who, in a sense, have the right to ask for an interview with Tom Brady, and even a lot of them wouldn't necessarily be granted them. And so you really were, even as a writer, kind of an outsider from the outside, looking in and desperately wanting to gain entrance, in a sense.
Yeah. For me, that was very much a part of the adventure, is kind of finding what it was like to try to be a sports writer. And so one of my favorite days was when the press secretary at the Patriots allowed me to come to a press conference. And so I got up to, you know, he said, okay, go to booth 17 or 11, whatever it was. And I got there and he said, what media outlet are you for my, you know, security tag? And I said, I don't know what media outlet am I. I guess I'm the college where I teach. And so I wrote down the college where I teach, and I went into through the security gate, and there I was, you know, at the field, and all I wanted to do was just sprint across the field, and you know, just do, you know, a 100-yard pretend kick return or something like that. But then I knew as soon as if I did anything like that, surely that would get on film, and then all of a sudden I'd never get this chance to have a genuine conversation with Tom Brady. So then I kind of got off the field and then went into the. There was a little door that said press, and I opened that up, and then there I was, you know, with all these sports writers, a lot of them that I had seen on TV or read their columns and things, and trying to figure out how to behave in the press conference room. And then all of a sudden we were ushered into the locker room, and how was I to behave in the locker room? It was a fascinating day.
Mm. As you embarked on this, you were kind of in middle age. And you and your friend at one point, I can't remember his name. You really tell us his nickname. I can't think of it now, but it's a buddy of yours. And you are at one point in your conversation are kind of joking with each other about, you know, how's your midlife crisis going? Say a word more about that, about this sort of quest and how much that might have had to do with the fact that maybe to some extent you were perhaps experiencing what a lot of people would call at least a mild case of a midlife crisis.
Yeah, that would be my oldest friend, Dump Truck, from Philadelphia.
Dump Truck, that's
yeah.
Right.
And we used to play one-on-one football growing up. You know, after we would watch NFL films for 3 hours, and you know, we'd tape up our hands and then go down and you know, basically tackle each other for all afternoon. Middle age was everything for this book, and that's part of my fascination with Brady. And so many people that I talked to were so fascinated with this idea about Brady, about sort of his confidence and his level of success. And as you know, probably for a lot of the listeners, when you arrive at a certain age, you're sort of assessed where you're at, and whether that's professionally or with your family, and trying to work through an acceptance that some of those ideas as you grew up that, hey, you know, if I just work really hard, I'm going to achieve everything that I want to achieve. And when you get older, you realize it doesn't always really work that way. There's luck, there's circumstances, or sometimes you really just don't have it, whether it's talent or whatever skills that you might not have. And so many people that I talked to were really fascinated with Brady's level of confidence. One of my favorite places actually was going to a Big Ten game at the Big House, and I had never experienced that. And you know, maybe a lot of listeners there, you know, been to a Wisconsin game or to, you know, to a Big Ten game, and just to see all those fields of fans, and no one's been really talking about Michigan with the whole Deflategate summer, but there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of devoted Tom Brady Michigan fans, and they think about him, you know, as a Wolverine, and the stories that they tell about him at Michigan, and you know, the adversity he went through, and fighting for his job, and you know how well he did towards the end. It's a really interesting story, and so many of the people I talked to in those tailgating fields, you know, were middle-aged guys like me, and remembered watching Brady play at Michigan, and just talked about how he was Michigan for them. You know, the quarterback in the Big House, and the confidence he must have had, and how, you know, he just kept playing through adversity, and no matter what other people said about him, he just kept going.
Hmm. One of the most interesting moments in this quest for you early on, relatively early on, came when you got to actually speak with Tom Brady's backup, who actually had to go in for him for essentially an entire season when he went down with a very serious injury, from which he eventually recovered, of course, and eventually Matt Cassel moved on to another team. But Matt Cassel actually did stunningly well as Tom Brady's replacement. And you had the opportunity to actually speak with him in what had to sort of feel like a warm-up for the main event. Tell us a little bit about that encounter and how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, that, like you said, that started pretty early on in my adventure in the off season, or maybe around the summer, as moving up into training camp. And Matt Cassel was with the Vikings then, and I wrote to the Vikings and said, hey, is it possible to speak with Matt Cassel? And, you know, a couple days later, they said, sure. And there I was in my office, and on my phone it said Minnesota Vikings. And, you know, the press guy came on, he said, hey, Matt Cassel's going to be on next. And then Matt Cassel came on, and I was talking to Matt Cassel, and he was a really nice guy, really warm, really great conversation, told all kinds of great stories, and I thought, gosh, maybe this actually isn't going to be that hard. Maybe a regular writer like me could talk to Tom Brady. And Matt Cassel told a lot of great stories, like you said, about that, you know, when Brady got injured, that first game of, I think it was 2007 season, 2008 season, and, you know, what that was like all of a sudden when the doctor came up out after seeing Brady and realizing that Brady's season was over, and basically said to Matt, you know, like in the middle of the first quarter, hey, the rest of the season is yours. And what
Wow.
that would have been like for Matt Cassel. And he said that when he went onto the field for the first drive, all of the New England fans stood up and applauded, which was kind of a, he said, was a really warm, exceptional response. And then he, you know, he was nervous for the first couple of plays, but then he threw a big bomb to Randy Moss, and then all of a sudden he loosened up. One great story Matt Castle told that I didn't include in the book, but I think was a, is a really intriguing one, is that when Matt Castle first got to training camp with the Patriots, he was kind of looking at real estate one ads because he didn't really think he would make the team. And Brady walked over to him and said, you have to put that away. You know, if you're here, you got to be completely committed, 100%. And even if that story is sort of, I don't know, maybe it's been changed over the years or maybe it's a little bit trite, but it, I think it says a lot about, you know, where someone needs to be. And, it, you know, it's a good lesson for all of us to sort of focus on
absolutely
what we're doing.
Absolutely. To have, I mean, and that's one of the reasons Tom Brady has achieved what he has, is that ferocious sense of focus, which he has. One of the really interesting aspects of this book, in some ways it's the heart and soul of it, aside from just the striving to meet Tom Brady, is the way in which you encounter a wide array of really interesting Patriots fans. And, of course, to many of them, you pose the question of what would you ask Tom Brady? And you end up amassing a really interesting array of questions from a variety of fans. And I find that so interesting, although I can't even quite sort out in my mind exactly why all of that is so very compelling. But there's something about that. It says a lot about football fans, and it says a lot about who Tom Brady is, and about when we feel this devotion to someone. A lot can be read into those interesting questions.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think so, too. And I think a lot of those questions often just say a lot about who we are as people and what we're interested in. You know, so many people, I mean, we saw it this summer, just the amount of energy and attention and passion and vitriol over this Deflategate stuff when obviously there are, you know, far more important things going on in the world. And yet it's just football and sport, it just gives us this opportunity to kind of unload and reflect back on ourselves. It was amazing when I set up these tables at South Station in Boston or at my local mall asking people what they wanted to ask Brady, or when I toured, you know, the tailgating fields outside the Big House, you know, that when people were asking me to ask something for Tom Brady, they were really asking, you know, what were their concerns? You know, what did they really care about? And, you know, at a certain point, you could start to predict what people were going to say. You know, you could look at that person and say, oh, they're going to ask about the money, you know, or they're going to ask about the fashion, or they're going to ask about Brady's politics, or they're going to ask actually about something more technical with football. Or for my optometrist, she wanted to know, does he wear contacts? That's all I really want to know.
One of the things that I liked about your extensive descriptions of Tom Brady is the fact that there are all these ways in which he is this incredibly impressive celebrity. I mean, and, you know, exceptionally handsome and married to a bombshell wife, I mean, who is so gorgeous, and together they enjoy this life of celebrity. And yet there are all these different ways in which Tom Brady somehow also manages to shed that and seems like a good person. And you know, the kind of person that you just like, and the ways in which he is remarkably down to earth for all of the ways in which his life is lived kind of up in the stratosphere. Can you just say a word about how he has managed to accomplish that? In some ways, that's as impressive as anything he's done on the football field.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary, and I like the author Charles Pierce talked about how the football player, you know, any, particularly the quarterback, is so much in the public eye, how much he's on television during a game. You know, they're even filming him, you know, when he's sitting on the sidelines. And that these guys aren't going into sports to be entertainers primarily. They're going to sports for the athletics, and yet there's so much that is put upon them as entertainers and speaking with the public. And, you know, even something like, if you're following the news yesterday, you know, Brady will say something about, you know, Donald Trump, and then all of a sudden this is, you know, Brady's official endorsement for who he thinks should be president. And you realize for someone like this that half of his life, starting in Michigan, he's been in the public eye and has had to watch every single thing that he says. And it's hard to imagine, you know, it's almost like a Lady Di kind of thing. You think, like, gosh, the pressure that these folks are on to be in the media's eye for so long. And with Deflategate and, you know, people that would be incensed that Brady wouldn't know how to sort of speak to the press or that he would be telling a falsehood to the public. You know, someone like him, he's been telling falsehoods to the public since he got into the league. You know, every football player, when they get up on that stand, are basically told to, you know, just wax over, hey, how's your finger? Oh, it's fine, you know. So it's a very interesting thing. But after talking to so many people and so many sports writers, it's and seeing him in press conferences, he really does seem to be really good with the press. And he manages to not talk poorly about people and to at least present himself as a real team player. And, you know, none of us really know him. I don't know anything about him. But either he is really, really well coached at working with the press, or he genuinely is a really good guy and tries to be a team player and works hard not to speak ill of anybody.
Well, as our listeners have probably gathered by now, we are on purpose not revealing how all of this ends at your request. So people need to read the book in order to hear how your quest to finally meet and interview and maybe even toss a football around with Tom Brady, how that quest ultimately ends. The book is also, to a large extent, about you becoming enamored with the game of football again after some years away. And you said that maybe it had something to do with turning 40 and becoming a father. Perhaps it's psychological, perhaps it's chemical. Have you yet figured out the answer to that question of why you found yourself drawn back to football so forcefully?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we try to identify what is our most masculine sport, you know, in the U.S., I think most people would agree that it's football in terms of at least the major ones. And, yeah, I think there was a certain element of me of, you know, kind of walking around with my daughter, who is amazing, you know, in the baby Bjorn, and, you know, just sort of feeling I wasn't quite, you know, the man that, you know, and I'm a literature professor. I, you know, what do I do at the end of the day? I send a lot of emails. I grade papers. I read books. You know, I would like to be working more with my hands and accomplishing more at the end of a day. And so it was a lot of thinking about, like, about masculinity in general. And here is, you know, Brady in so many ways is such like the alpha gorilla, you know. I mean, he is, you know, accomplished so much in one of the most masculine environments out there.
Well, the book is just terrific. Again, it's called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback, published by 4Edge, and the author, Richard J. King. Richard King, congrats on a great book, and thank you for making time for this interview. It was fun to talk with you. Best wishes.
Oh, so nice for you to have me on, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be talking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, making his monthly visit to the program to offer his thoughts on various current events. He is an expert on both North and South Korea, so we will be sure to spend part of our time talking about Korea and the Olympic Games that they are hosting. We'll also, of course, be talking about the Parkland High School shooting in Florida and the prospects of real progress being made on the issue of gun control. On Friday, Michael Finkel, author